moving closely over the jacket and goggles of a wartime pilot. James Holland writes in a notebook.
I've been researching and writing about the Second World War for years. Along the way, I've interviewed veterans from almost every theatre of war. Each one has been a privilege to meet, but for me, one man stands out. Captain Eric Winkle Brown, probably the best pilot this country has ever produced.
A black and white portrait.
He didn't fly for the RAF, though. Captain Brown was in the Fleet Air Arm, a pilot for the Royal Navy. His career spans a remarkable period in aviation, from wood and canvas biplanes through to experimental Nazi jets and on to nuclear bombers at the height of the Cold War. But his experience extends way beyond his achievements in the air. From visiting Germany as a teenager in 1936, he witnessed some of the most extraordinary events leading up to and during the Second World War. Captain Brown is a truly remarkable man. This is his story.
Black and white footage of a small jet being pulled out of a hangar by a number of people.
To achieve supersonic flight was the holy grail of aviation in my time.
Fire spits out of its jet engine.
Here you had a new airplane, more power, more thrust, more aerodynamic refinement. I had got down to 4,000 feet. Suddenly the aircraft went into a violent oscillation. I was beginning to lose consciousness. The one thought was survival. How do I get this sorted out? What I did was hold the throttle, hold the stick, just hold both back gently together.
Old footage of the aeroplane levelling out.
My name is Captain Eric Brown. My last job was Chief Naval Test Pilot to the Fleet Air Arm.
BBC, Britain's Greatest Pilot. The extraordinary story of Captain Winkle Brown. Eric stands in a forest wearing a V-neck jumper over his shirt and tie, his white hair neatly brushed. Then he's at a desk.
My first actual flight was with my father. I would be about 10 years of age, much to my mother's absolute horror. I suppose she wanted to preserve her young son. Mothers do.
Moving slowly through the clouds above countryside.
We're in a single-seat biplane. I was allowed to hold the stick, but of course, obviously, I couldn't reach the rudder pedals. So it was just a gentle experience, if you like. But he had pressed the right button.
A photo of Eric as a young man.
I've always had in my life a tendency to try something hazardous. I was the only one at school that had a motorbike of 500cc Norton. I used to make my summer money by being a motorbike rider on the Wall of Death.
Motorcyclists ride around it.
Then in 1936, the big event happened in my life that persuaded me to take up flying. My father had been a Royal Flying Corps pilot in World War I. The Germans had a Society of World War I combatants. They decided to invite their opposition over to have a shindig during the Berlin Olympics in 1936.
The opening ceremony.
Der 11. Olympiade neuer Zeitrechnung als eröffnet.
That was Herr Hitler announcing it open. Now they're all cheering him, and the whole crowd have raised their right arm.
A track race is started.
The great event, of course, was the wonderful Jesse Owens. Here was a man who won 100 metres and 200 metres, the long jump, and the 4 by 100 metre relay. Four gold medals, not exactly what Hitler with his Aryan ideals had wanted. I've read many stories that said Hitler ignored him. Now, this is quite untrue because I actually witnessed Hitler shaking hands with Jesse Owens and congratulating him on what he had achieved.
Athletics weren't the only thing on show, because amongst Eric's hosts was fighter ace Ernst Udet.
Ernst Udet became famous in World War I, the top-scoring pilot after Richthofen.
Photos of Udet posing in front of a plane's propellers, then sitting in the cockpit, both showing his serious expression.
He had many lady friends, cigar-smoking, champagne-drinking sort of chap, bigger than life. He said, now we're going flying, and I was in the front cockpit, he was in the rear. He took particular attention to strap me in very carefully. I thought, no, that's just how nice of him, you know, but there was a purpose in it, as I found out.
A plane flies upside down.
He really threw that thing around. He turned it inside out.
It loops the loop.
We came into land, and on the approach, he turned it onto its back. I thought, well, he'll turn it over before. But nothing happened. He kept coming on, and I thought, really? I think the silly old fool's had a heart attack. And I really thought it was going to be my demise. But he turned it round and it literally fell onto the runway. This is how good a pilot he was.
The plane lands.
He slapped me on the back and said the German fighter pilot's greeting, Halsen Beinbruch. He said, you'll make a good fighter pilot. And he said, now do two things for me. Learn to speak German and then learn to fly. It was a pivotal point in my life.
Soldiers in the street.
German troops made a formal entry into the demilitarized zone on the left bank of the Rhine. Herr Hitler confirmed the reoccupation of the Rhine.
Hitler stands on a balcony saluting and waving. Smiling children in the crowd hold their right arms out in salute. The place names Frankfurt and Köln come up. On his return home, Eric attended Edinburgh University. By 1938, he could both fly and speak German.
I had achieved the two things that Udet had challenged me to do. So I wrote him, and he said, yes, I'll book you into a little Gasthaus. We'll show you a bit of Berlin.
Black and white footage of Berlin from above, then down on the ground. Crowds of people sitting at tables by a river, then lots of couples dancing together in a park.
I was, in my teens, politically naive. I really was just having a wonderful experience. It seemed a very vibrant country, lots of uniforms to be seen around.
Children play together and toss someone in the air.
The Hitler Youth seemed to offer slightly more than the Boy Scouts offered, if you like to put it that way.
Three huge red Nazi banners hang down at a vast rally.
Nuremberg was a rallying point. What's the biggest thing we do here? I suppose it was like the coronation with knobs on. The only thing that drove me to want to see it was curiosity. People said, oh, it's a fabulous show. You know, you must go and see it. There are so many people packed into one place, all hugely enthusiastic.
The crowd salutes.
I began to wonder, how does this man attract all these people? I thought there must be some strange charisma. He's like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, and they're all following him as he lants along.
A map with Germany in dark red.
Of the triumphs of Hitler, his annexation of Austria, the crushing of Czechoslovakia, it has been a year of crises, and we can hardly ignore them. But it has also been the year of the Lambeth Walk, and we may be grateful to that dance phenomenon which has helped to preserve our sense of values. For even gas masks and ARP have been unable to still that undaunted oi!
Eric turns the pages of his scrapbook. In 1939, with Europe in turmoil, Eric returned to Germany at the request of the British government.
A little group from the Foreign Office asked me if I was interested in joining the diplomatic corps. And I said I was, and they said, right, we will send you to Germany for 6 months.
Cars on a country road.
In early September, I decided to go up to Munich for a weekend and drive up in my car.
A photo of Eric sitting on his car, wearing overalls, with three children standing around it.
On the 3rd of September, at about 6 in the morning, there was a thunderous knock on my door. Two SS officers said, I have to tell you, you're under arrest because our two countries are at war. Now, technically, this was untrue because 11 o'clock was the time, but I wasn't in a strong position to argue.
Big Ben strikes 11.
The same hour that chimed for armistice tolls the signal for another war.
Soldiers march.
They took all clothes I had, books, etc., and off we went.
A German river.
I was in a little SS jail. I wasn't at all ill-treated. On the third day, one of the young SS lieutenant came to me and said, we're taking you down to the Swiss frontier.
Driving through the mountains.
When we arrived, the lieutenant said to me, you're free to go and you can take your car. So I said, you've taken my clothes, my books, my money. Why are you giving me my car? And he said in German, because we have no spares. Very Teutonic attitude.
Preparations for war.
But now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be.
I was taken to Bern, and the ambassador said, of course, I've been told to return you as soon as possible because you've been called up.
Men waiting at a bus stop are transformed to wearing soldiers' uniforms.
I was keen to get back at the Germans. I was a bit piqued about being locked up. And I was young, raring to go. Suddenly on the notice board, they went a thing saying, the Navy have lost a lot of pilots. There is a shortage. And if you're interested in moving over to the fleet arm, append your name to the board. So I did that very thing.
A photo portrait of Eric in his pilot's hat and suit. footage of children running for cover during an air raid, and a baby being put into a large gas mask helmet.
Here comes the Luftwaffe. Hundreds of planes, bombers, fighters. The RAF came and dove in, shouting the old hunting cry, "Tally-ho!"
Guns fire at a plane and hit it. Eric's at his desk with the scrapbook. Eric became a trained fighter pilot on HMS Audacity, protecting the Atlantic convoys from bomber attack.
HMS Audacity originally was a banana boat operating in the Caribbean. Churchill, was his original idea, he thought, right, cut everything off so that we can lay a flat flight deck on it to operate aircraft.
A pilot looks out of his cockpit.
The Wildcat, as the Americans called it, was an aircraft that had a bigger punch than the British aircraft of that time. Instead of 0.303 guns, it had 0.5 guns.
Far out in the grey Atlantic, the big Buck of Wolf bombers range far and wide across the ocean, seeking out the convoys approaching British shores.
The Courier was probably the most heavily armed German aircraft in the sky. It had machine guns firing out the side windows, cannon, two turrets on top, and a complete gondola underneath. All told, it was very heavily armed. Realizing what I was up against, I had studied this very carefully. Worked out how the guns could depress or elevate. There was only one black spot which they couldn't reach, and that was if you came in flat towards the pilot's cockpit.
A pilot pours steaming drink from a flask. Colour footage of a faster plane, then torn damage on a wing.
When I opened fire, we could see the windscreen just disintegrating, so the pilots must have been killed. You were in grave danger with colliding with your target, and you had to break away either up or down.
The pilot in the film pulls up.
You get that exhilarating feeling that you've nailed him.
Submarines plough through the sea.
The U-boats lie in waiting. Like wolves, they will stalk a convoy for days at a stretch, biding their time until the chance of wind and weather offers the fattest prize to their torpedoes.
HMS Audacity's success in defending the convoy made it a specific target for the German U-boats.
We realised we were going to be under attack, so the captain of Audacity thought we'll zigzag at full speed for the night. A lone submarine let fly at us, caught the rudder. We were in darkness by this time. We'd barely stopped when the submarine surfaced, about 200 yards away on our port side. It was a neary sight. As it popped out of the sea, it was covered in phosphorescence. It was almost as if it was a Christmas tree lights on it all over. The commander came up onto the conning tower. We could see the gold braid on his hat. We were that close. He just leant over the tower surveying us. We just stood and watched each other. Somebody's nerve broke, one of the seamen, and he leapt to a 20mm Oerlikon gun and started firing at the submarine. I thought he'll irritate the U-boat captain, which is what he did, of course. And the next thing was he just fired off a bevy of torpedoes at us.
Explosions in the darkness.
Our carrier reared up. I heard the twang of the hawsers holding the aircraft breaking. The six aircraft just broke loose, mowed down the deck into all these guys standing there, and absolute chaos.
A ship sinks.
We were all swimming as fast as we could to get away from the vessel. Turned round and she plunged down very rapidly. Tremendous booming as things imploded.
Nighttime.
There were a hell of a lot of people in the water, of course, by this time. Another pilot called out and he said, "Let's tie ourselves together." I think we were 24 altogether. Now, at first, we were all fine. We talked to each other and everything, but after about 3/4 of an hour, everybody stopped talking and falling asleep.
The black water rises and falls.
These chaps were falling forward because there's nothing to support their heads and were drowning.
The sea grows rougher.
My section leader said, "The only thing we can do is cut them off from us, otherwise we'll all go down together, the whole 24 of us." So this continued right throughout the night, cutting one or two away and letting them drift off. It really was a very nasty business. By the morning, all the seamen had drowned. There were only two of us left.
The waves roll into a rocky shore beneath dark clouds. Then, a layer of white cloud passes quickly beneath a pale blue sky. Eric stands in the forest, looking around. Then he's going through his scrapbook. Eric returned to Britain, left active combat, and became a test pilot.
Unknown to me, the captain of the Audacity said I had a facility for deck landing and the Admiralty should make use of it.
A Navy crew photograph.
I got a telegram asking me to undertake a series of trials on various carriers.
A plane lands on a carrier and upends onto its nose.
Hellcat comes in too quickly. Pilot seems none the worse.
This landing is particularly bad.
With this machine coming in, one would think all is well.
It hits the net.
Deck landing, one has to accept, is quite a hazardous business.
A firebrand bends on destruction.
Accidents were 10 a penny. Here you see another aircraft. If it doesn't have an accident, it'll be a very unusual affair.
It crashes with its tail in the air.
Did you crash many times?
No, I only had one crash caused by a hook not lowering and the batsman not having seen it.
A picture-by-picture analysis of the slow-motion film proved very useful.
A plane takes off.
As you go off on the catapult, like you're doing here, you do get a pretty big kick in the pants. You are very hopeful that there's enough wind for you to get off cleanly.
Several planes come into land and don't crash. During the war, Eric made 2,407 carrier landings. A world record that stood for over 65 years. The mosquito.
the story of the DH-98, or Mosquito, is one of brilliant success. At the moment, the fastest aircraft in operation in the world.
Footage of its abilities.
The Mosquito is a superb airplane. I was asked to put it aboard an aircraft carrier. It was twice as heavy as any aircraft that had ever been landed on a carrier, was twice as big. The top entry speed that we could land was 86 miles an hour. The stalling speed of the Mosquito is 110. Hence, everybody said it impossible.
One crashes.
This picture shows the Mosquito doing crash barrier tests in HMS Triumph.
The wings break up.
By all appearances, wooden constructed aeroplanes would just seem to be unsuitable for this treatment.
But when you're young and confident, you say brash things.
Another Mosquito approaches the flight deck and lands successfully, coming to an easy stop.
This de Havilland Mosquito was the first two-engine machine to land on an aircraft carrier.
The pilot was Lieutenant Commander E.M. Brown.
This really changed my life because the director of the REE said to me later, "Frankly, I didn't think I'd ever see you again." Then I was promoted and became the chief naval test pilot at Farnborough.
The plane's taken down into the hold on a platform with its wings folded. With this promotion, Eric moved to a house near the Royal Aircraft Establishment, Farnborough. V1.
V1, the flying bomb, the robot bomb, the buzz bomb. You're a passenger on a bus, and this is the end of your last trip. You're the man on the street, and you do what you can. You're an airman on leave, and this is your welcome mat.
The debris of a bomb blast.
I was on duty. V1 crashed in the garden of our house. The house collapsed like a pack of cards. My wife was concussed, and our cleaning lady lost an eye and had 96 stitches. Poor thing, she came out of it rather badly.
A V1's launched at speed.
The problem with attacking the V1 is it came over at a steady speed of 400 miles an hour. Even if you caught up with it and fired, the debris from it was likely to damage your own aircraft.
One shot down in a huge fireball in the sky.
Between sorties, the pilots got together to discuss the best methods of attack.
We devised a method of flying alongside it and putting your wing under the V1's wing. Then if you raise your wing, you'll tilt the V1 over in the other direction, and then away it'll go.
A V1 drops down into the sea.
The best plane, I would say the Tempest 5. It had the speed to overtake. It was a pretty rugged airplane too, and it had the control to do the tipping.
Several of them take off.
I was doing a series of trials, and the engine blew up, and the propeller went absolutely solid. I saw the engine was on fire outside. I didn't realize I was burning inside until my feet cooked. I realized that I had to get out. Bailing out is not as easy as many people think. And when I stood up in the cockpit to grip my legs over the side, I was pinned back by sheer slipstream effect. So then what I did was get one leg over the side, one leg on the seat. Lean in, get hold of the stick, pull it hard over towards me, and that catapulted me out.
Footage of a pilot bailing from his smoking plane.
You don't get much time to worry about the finer points of it. The thing is, get out and move out.
Eric continues to turn the pages of his scrapbook and look at the pictures. Some of him, others of a whole squadron, or of their planes.
In test flying, we had a high casualty rate. Year after year, 25% of the pilots involved in high-speed flight were lost. This was for a very great cause, to keep our aircraft ahead of the enemy. It was them today, it might be me tomorrow. One just had to shrug it off and say, war is on, there are huge casualties, they are just part of the cost.
A photo of Eric smiling as he poses on a plane with three pilots standing in front of him and his hand on one of their shoulders. A huge crowd in the city.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is everywhere. We have never seen a greater day than this.
With the end of the war in Europe, Eric was sent on a special mission. A large engine's pushed on a trolley towards an aeroplane.
The director of the REE formed a mission to go to Germany after the capitulation and find out more about their technology.
The plane's towed down a runway.
I was more than impressed. I was shocked by what we found, because they were so far ahead.
Eric kept a log of his search for the Luftwaffe's most secret aircraft. Fire shoots out of a plane's jet engine and it begins takeoff.
This is the Messerschmitt 262, the world's first operational jet fighter. It was more than 100 miles an hour faster than the best piston engine fighter.
This was a lightning-fast airplane. It looks in body form like a shark. Swept-back wings and the underslung engines. It really looks power, power, power. When I got the ME-262 in the air, it was so fast, it was virtually untouchable. It had four 30-millimeter cannon, which is a huge punch. Batteries of rockets. I saw an American Marauder aircraft being attacked by an ME-262.
Old footage.
1 minute there was this beautiful looking Marauder in the sky, a minute later, confetti.
Pieces of the plane dropped to the ground.
I've flown almost all the World War II aircraft, and I rank it as the most formidable aircraft of World War II.
Streets of destroyed buildings.
Amid the ruins, the day's people wander here and there.
Nothing is left undamaged.
Battered and shell-swept, not much remains.
A German officer sits down.
One of the first war criminals is captured, Hermann Göring.
In his journal, Eric writes, Luxembourg, Palace Hotel, Göring. In June 1945, Eric was offered the chance to interrogate Reichsmarschall Göring.
Göring was Hitler's right-hand man, head of the Luftwaffe. I was quite taken aback at how slimmed down from all the pictures I'd ever seen of him as a rather porky gentleman.
A colour photo of him.
The Americans had weaned him off drugs. They had stripped him of all insignia. He had been interrogated day in and day out. But the invigilating officer said to him, "Now you're going to be interrogated by a pilot." And literally, he brightened up instantly. The first question I asked him was, "What, in your opinion, was the outcome of the Battle of Britain?" And he said, "It was a draw." He said, "If you look at the analysis of the battle, you will find that in the last week, for the first time, the German casualties were lower than the British." Now, this is perfectly true if you look at the records. And he said this showed a turning point had been arrived at.
The jaws of the Nazi whale were set to swallow Jonah.
But he said, unfortunately, we couldn't continue because Hitler ordered all fighter units back for the invasion of Russia.
Film of Goering inspecting planes.
I've told many people this, and nobody said, "Oh no, you got that wrong." Many of them are saying, "My God, weren't we lucky?"
He shakes a pilot's hand.
At the end, he came over and stuck his hand out to shake hands. Now, I couldn't, under any circumstances, shake hands. So I thought, the hell do I do now? And very quickly, I suddenly said to him, "Halfsen Beinbruch," the old fighter pilot's greeting. He half smiled and just dropped his hand.
What does Halse Beinbruch mean?
Broken neck and broken legs was the greeting. Go in there and do your stuff. Maybe that's what you'll get, but as long as you survive.
If you'll just answer my questions, we'll save a great deal of time. Concentration camps was one of the things you found immediately necessary upon coming to power, is it not?
Das habe ich.
Having been to Belsen, I realized that Goering had a huge responsibility for the concentration camps.
Your answer is yes, I think.
Yeah.
Erich's journal reads Liberation of Belsen. Just 2 months earlier, Erich had been part of the British force that liberated the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp.
As the Allied procession moved onward, prison camps were broken open.
German soldiers stand in a line, waiting.
When we arrived at the gates, we could see the soldiers waiting for us. The Germans had discovered there were 20,000 cases of typhus in Belsen. They thought if the guards, the inmates escape, we'll have a plague, which could be worse than the war.
Topless, emaciated men.
I spoke to one or two, but they were like zombies. When you stopped them, they would stop. They wouldn't look at you, they would just look at the ground. Not reply at all. When you finished, they would move aside and move on. They were literally dying zombies.
One walks slowly in huge boots.
I could see huts. These had originally been built to accommodate 60 inmates. When we got there, there were about 250 in each hut.
Skeletal men sit and stare in silence.
These people were theoretically still alive. But I say alive, brackets.
To a British military tribunal has brought a sordid assortment of Nazi war criminals, headed by the notorious Joseph Kramer, charged with responsibility for torture and mass murder of 50,000 prisoners at the German death camp at Belsen.
Erich was the first to question the camp commandants, Josef Kramer, and Irma Gracer.
Cramer was absolutely straightforward. He realised the game was up. He didn't make excuses like I was obeying orders. He just said, you know, I had a job to do, and I did it.
Nelson's women, as savage as any of the men. Kramer's chief assistant, 21 years old and a veteran of 5 years of atrocities, is Fräulein Irma Gracer.
Irma Gracer, she was the female camp commandant at Auschwitz, had a dreadful reputation for cruelty to the female inmates there. Cruelty seemed to be a second part of her nature, gave me an overpowering sense of evil, and right away I classed her as the worst human being I had ever met.
The German prisoners file into the hearing with numbered cards hanging around their necks.
My experience of the Germans before the war was a very friendly one. I admired them for their disciplined way of life. They were hard workers. But my attitude totally changed when I witnessed what I did in Belsen. Because I thought, if these people are capable of this, they are just an evil race.
Soldiers march in formation.
I began to query them, did they know about these concentration camps and how did they justify them? Their excuse was they had been offered something to put their country back to where it had previously been by Hitler. And they would have followed anybody that offered them this.
Hitler greets a young boy, then a partially destroyed building.
Outside Hitler's bunker are 5 petrol cans used for burning his body. The whole of this Reich Chancellery has fallen to pieces. In the center of Hitler's study stands his chair in a confusion of smashed woodwork, of filth and rubble.
Fallen planks cover the floor of the room. In the wreckage of Germany, Erich discovered the Luftwaffe's most advanced rocket aircraft. A plane with a tiny propeller.
The ME-163 is a rocket jet plane, carries its own oxygen supply, therefore is not hampered by thinning atmosphere and high altitude.
ME-163 was a rocket interceptor. Everything about it was new and different. Sweepback, semi-tailless, skid landing, almost like an expanded bullet. But above all, it was rocket-powered. Oh, it's dangerous to fly, extreme, because of the volatility of the fuels.
In a demonstration, fuel is drawn into a pipette and squeezed onto rock, where it flares and sparks.
Its operational record was terrible. The number of its own pilots it killed was huge, really.
The small planes towed.
It could go up to a very high Mach number, but once you had passed that number, you'd lost control of the aircraft. And it would tuck under. There was no way out until it made a hole in the ground.
Smoke pours from the engine.
If you landed with as much as a half a cupful of fuel, the impact of landing would explode the whole thing.
The thruster burns and the plane takes off.
I'm sitting in the cockpit, ready to go.
It bounces off down the runway in a trail of thick smoke.
The noise is thunderous, and you are given a bit of a shake-up on the takeoff.
It climbs steeply.
The acceleration is unbelievable.
It flies above the clouds, white smoke pouring from it.
I thought the performance was, there's only one word for it, phenomenal. I felt that I was flying in a tin coffin because your chances of bailing out were virtually nil. I took it on in the full knowledge of what the risk was. But at the end of the day, I felt a tremendous satisfaction in having beaten the odds.
It lands.
I think this is one of the most attractive aspects of flying, taking on danger and winning. Because you know what there waits for you if you don't win.
Through the sound barrier.
A few months after war ended, trials of the tailless DH-108 began with Geoffrey de Havilland's flight at Woodbridge.
To achieve supersonic flight was the holy grail of aviation in my time.
Eric looks at photos of the jet.
At the end of the war, the de Havilland team visited Germany and were fascinated by the 163. So de Havilland swept the wings back 45 degrees, upped the jet engine to about 3,500 pounds of thrust.
They fire it up.
He decided to prepare for an attempt on the world speed record.
A man climbs into the cockpit.
Our chief test pilot was Geoffrey de Havilland, the son of the founder of the company. I knew Geoffrey very well, saw a lot of Geoffrey. To me, Geoffrey was more of the Hollywood type of test pilot.
He takes off.
The way he was going to work up for it was to start with high-speed runs at 10,000 feet. Come down 1,000 feet at a time, keep full throttle on each run. And he was running at 7 when suddenly the aircraft disintegrated.
Photographs of the plane's mangled wreckage and people standing over it.
The aircraft debris and Geoffrey's body fell on Egypt Bay near the estuary of the Thames. Geoffrey was still in his parachute, but it had never been attempted to be opened. So right away, there was the first mystery. Secondly, it was found that Geoffrey had a broken neck. The cause of the disintegration was to be investigated, and this was given to Farnborough.
The plane taking off.
I started to follow the same pattern of flight that he had gone on. I'd got down to 4,000 feet. Suddenly the aircraft went into a violent oscillation. It did 3 cycles a second, and in each cycle, I was subjected to plus 4G and minus 3G. The medics say that a pilot will stand this for 10 seconds before going unconscious. The one thought was survival. How do I get this sorted out? I was beginning to lose consciousness. So what I did was hold the throttle, hold the stick, and this was pure instinct. Just hold both back gently together.
He mimes the action with both hands, and the plane in the film levels out.
As suddenly as it happened, after 7 seconds, it stopped.
It lands and races across the wet ground, then taxis back to the hangar.
I was pretty pleased about it, I can tell you. I could see clearly that Jeffrey's head had probably violently struck the canopy, broken his neck, and that was it.
Grey clouds pass quickly above the dark trees silhouetted beneath it.
When you take on a job like that, part of it is a dare, part of it is a professional challenge. Somebody done an analysis of my flying and they say I've had 13 that might have finished up fatal. But I don't know. I think the two things have contributed to my survival. I was a stickler for preparation before a flight. There was a type of pilot who was a bit gung-ho. The great saying would be, kick the tires, light the fires, and the last one off's a sissy. Now, if you have that attitude in test flying, you are not going to last very long. And secondly, the fact I am small helped my survival. For example, I had a crash in a Vampire. If I'd been 6 feet, I'd have lost my legs. I survived purely because I was small, and I curled myself up in the cockpit.
Eric's small stature was the reason his colleagues nicknamed him Winkle, a plane with two tails joined by one crossfin at the end.
De Havilland were developing a jet fighter, the Vampire, and there was a strong desire to operate jet aircraft from carriers.
In December 1945, Eric attempted the first ever carrier landing of a jet.
We knew the Americans were trying to be the first to land a jet on an aircraft carrier, and it was nothing but a friendly rivalry. The sea was so rough, the carrier was moving, enough to make life difficult, certainly for the first landing. So the signal had been sent out, return to base. But I didn't get that. So I screamed overhead, and that was the first they knew I was there.
The crew wait on board the carrier as the jet makes its approach to land. It comes in steady and straight, and just makes the deck, catches the hook, and stops.
Another page of history was written on December the 3rd, 1945. When LZ-551 landed on and took off from HMS Ocean, the first jet aircraft ever to operate from a ship at sea.
And the pilot, Lieutenant Commander Brown, Winkle to his friends. The event is the cause of interest. Some very considerable interest.
They swarm around the plane.
Here it is, coming up from below, still surrounded and commanding attention. The pilot can be seen in the foreground without a helmet. Where does the urge come from? Feelings believing.
They inspect the plane.
The Goofers Gallery, as we call it, was filled with brass, top brass, and they all flooded down onto the flight deck. The sailors who operate the arrestor gear, etc., they all came round, and the one thing they wanted to do was warm their hands from the jet engine.
Half a dozen of them stand behind it with their hands out.
Running up at full power before taking off. The spectators are a little more distant, behind something, somewhere. There was no trouble with a free takeoff. A new era had started and the aircraft had come to stay.
The plane takes off smoothly and banks away. Eric looks at a black and white photo of the carrier. Clouds pass beneath the sun. Then Eric's standing outside in front of the trees. A more modern fighter jet with two pilots.
2-0-7-0.
Down you go. Okay, standard under the low descent.
By the mid-60s, I was moving up the seniority ladder. It was likely that I'd get an air station. Being a good Scot, I was praying that I'd get Lossiemouth, the training ground for nuclear bombers.
A jet comes in to land on a carrier.
When I first went to the Fleet Air Arm, the first aircraft I flew was the biplane Gladiator. You finish up, and the end of my career, the Buccaneer. They were as different from that early era as chalk from cheese. War had pushed progress along so fast, at a huge cost, of course, in money and in lives. When you compare these two eras with the biplane and the Buccaneer, you are talking about destructive loads are being delivered with accuracy that was unbelievable in those early days.
Three fly in formation.
Science fiction almost.
Flying through thin clouds, high above fields and towards the coast. Captain Eric Winkle Brown has flown 487 different aircraft types. This world record is unlikely to ever be beaten. Names of planes zoom by.
At first, when I had to retire from flying, I think it was a feeling similar to a drug addict gives when he no longer can get his drugs. Withdrawal symptoms were fierce for about a year. And then I came to terms with it after a year, but it wasn't easy.
Flying along a rural coastline.
One thing I learned about myself was I was prepared to give up anything to stay in test flying. For 6 years at Farnborough, I virtually never had a day's leave. That is a terrible imposition on your family. So there are prices to be paid.
Eric stands looking out of the window of his bungalow.
It did become an obsession with me, and it was something I felt I had to do, otherwise my soul, if you like to put it that way, would never be at peace.
He turns another page in his scrapbook. The photo of him sitting on a plane while three other pilots stand in front of him, smiling.
Wings over the Navy, wings over the sea. We're top of the service, the Navy's cavalry. High over the ocean.